The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's great to be with you, off and running on another work week here at Edstone. Had a beautiful day yesterday, a nice outdoor wedding. Congratulations to Chris and Panay. A wonderful evening, beautiful sunshiny day. And so they're off and running on their honeymoon. Great to see another family developing here in the UK region. Well, since the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis police have lost 10% of their force. And you know all about the defund the police movement, redirecting funds, as some of the politicians are saying. You know, we're just using it for other programs that are going to make our community safer. They're going to be safe because of these new measures that we're putting in place. Well, 40 policemen have resigned in Minneapolis alone, and another 70 are still on medical leave of some kind. And guess what? Violence continues to rise. Crime and violence. And so you have, well, in some cases, residents are expressing their displeasure with the police and some of the police tactics. And yet, on the other hand, they're saying, we need the police because it's getting dangerous. This is a letter sent to the residents of the 3rd Precinct. This is law enforcement sending a notice out to warn people. It says this: robberies and carjackings have increased in our precinct. Cell phones, purses, and vehicles are being targeted. Some victims have been maced, dragged, assaulted, and some threatened with a gun. It says 100 robberies and 20 carjackings have been reported to the 3rd Precinct Policy in July alone. Now, if the 3rd Precinct sounds familiar, that's because that's the precinct that was abandoned in late May. They left. Remember, the police force just left the building, and the rioters and the looters, they went in and ransacked the place, and they burned it to the ground. That's just 2 months ago. 2 months ago. Who can forget the Minneapolis mayor, Jacob Frey, who said that, well, after I heard how dangerous the situation had become, I told the police to leave. This is clip one.
After receiving real-time information from our chief, Arredondo, and after having numerous phone calls with him regarding the evolving situation at the 3rd Precinct, it became clear that there were imminent threats to both officers and public. And I made the decision to evacuate the 3rd Precinct.
He made the decision to evacuate. So they evacuated, and the precinct was burned to the ground. And now, 2 months on, they're sending out notices to residents saying, hey, you better be careful. There's a good chance you could be mugged. So don't carry valuables. Make sure you're not carrying a lot of cash and so on. People's lives are in danger. And they're receiving written notices from the precinct that crime is skyrocketing. And what did the mayor, what was his reasoning back then, just 2 months ago? Well, listen again, clip two.
The symbolism of a building cannot outweigh the importance of life, of our officers, or the public. We could not risk serious injury to anyone. Brick and mortar is not as important as life.
Brick and mortar is not as important, and we could not risk injury to anyone, so they evacuated. And you know what he said in that same statement? Now, don't worry, we're still going to police our neighborhoods. We're still going to protect our citizens. And what did they say in this notice they sent out just last week? 100 robberies, 20 carjackings, just in the third precinct. I'm not sure how much territory that covers, but that's figures for July alone. And now they're sending out instructions. You know, be careful, you might be mugged. And Minneapolis, this is where the raging inferno got started, all this violence, all this rioting that swept across the nation. Minneapolis is not unique. New York City, they've defunded the police. They've laid off law enforcement officials. And there was a story today from over the weekend how that the sanitation budget has now been cut by over $100 million. This is a city in trouble. Defund the police and defund the sanitation department. How to ruin a city in a matter of months. Let's just let the trash heaps pile high and get rid of the officers. And we'll have our Marxist utopia. Far from utopia. This was a headline at CNBC. Retail rents plummet across New York City as America's glitzy shopping districts turn into ghost towns. See the riots this time around, as we've noted in recent weeks. Quite a lot different than the riots back in the early 1990s in Los Angeles, where they swept across quite a few of the poorer neighborhoods. But this time around, it was, you know, it was Fifth Avenue in New York. It was the ritzy districts. And now rent is plummeting, even in some of the more expensive places in New York City. Premier shops in Manhattan are closing up for good. Neiman Marcus closed down. Barney's is boarded up. And like I say, this is happening in other cities as well. Chicago's Michigan Avenue, the Magnificent Mile, Rodeo Drive in Los Angeles, the Las Vegas Strip. City officials, they're scrambling in these areas to try to keep the peace after they've essentially handed over the cities to the mobs, to the rioters. And people, understandably, are looking for ways to get out. Businesses are leaving. Ordinary citizens are packing up and moving elsewhere. Too much crime, too much violence. Is this prophetically significant? Well, consider what the prophet Isaiah, or rather Ezekiel, had to say. He said in chapter 7, "Violence has risen up into a rod of wickedness. None of them shall remain, nor their multitude, nor any of their theirs, neither shall there be wailing for them." And then down in verse 23, it says, "Make a chain, for the land is full of bloody crimes, and the city is full of violence." Make a chain. It's just one chain reaction after another. One chain linked to another. The city is full of violence. Cities are just replete with crime and violence and murder. In the case of Chicago, I'll come to that here in just a second. But you think about what Jesus prophesied in the Gospels regarding our civilization right here at the end, right here in the last days. Genesis 6 and verse 5 talks about the days before the flood of Noah, or Noah's day. And Christ said it would be the same way today. And so we look at our cities, Minneapolis, New York City, Chicago. This is from Portland. Powerline had to say this over the weekend. Portland, Oregon recorded 15 homicides in July. That's the most in one month in more than three decades, according to the police. The most homicides in more than three decades in Portland. That's the month of July. And we see pictures every single night of what's happening in Portland. Antifa, Black Lives Matter. It says here, as for shootings, there were 63 in July. In 2019, there were 28. 28. This is according to the police department there. The police chief noted that the department was forced to disband its 34-member gun violence reduction team. So they got rid of the gun violence reduction team, and shooting skyrocketed, more than doubled. It says, according to this report, the unit was eliminated on July 1st, apparently in response to the disproportionate number of blacks being pulled over in traffic stops or something. So we're worried about the traffic stops. We've got to do justice for George. We've got to make sure we even it out between the whites and the blacks as far as routine traffic stops are concerned. We'll just totally disband this unit. And what happens? 28 shootings last July, 63 shootings this July, 15 homicides. Portland, Oregon, the city of Portland. Listen to this letter that the Seattle police chief sent to the city council up in Seattle. Seattle's just a few hours north of Portland, and we know about the violence that's happened there, and those thugs that set up the autonomous zone, Chaz Chop. Here's what the police chief said. Carmen Best, she said, a residence of mine in Snohomish County was targeted by a large group of aggressive protesters late last night. So this happened over the weekend, I presume. My neighbors were concerned by such a large group, but they were successful in ensuring the crowd was not able to trespass or engage in other illegal behavior in the area, despite repeated attempts to do so. It says currently the local sheriff is monitoring the situation. So here come the thugs. They're going after the police chief. She's an African-American woman, by the way. A black woman. They're going after her. You see, it's not about race. It's about defunding and actually destroying law enforcement. Yesterday here in the UK, down in London, you had these uniformed Black Lives Matter troops, basically. They're coming out in what looks like riot gear. Here's this, just a few seconds of this yesterday. These people marching to orders, clip three.
Face about.
Look at what they're wearing. Looks like riot gear. Nigel Farage, he spoke out against the protest on Twitter. Forget about the social distancing. He said the Public Order Act of 1936 prohibits by law paramilitary and political uniforms. Why is the Metropolitan Police allowing this to happen? Why? The police are basically setting up the perimeter so that these people have space to protest. Now, I didn't read of any violence, but these are the exceptions to all the other rules that everyone else is expected to abide by with respect to the COVID pandemic. We'll come to that in just a second. You see the double standard everywhere that you look. Clip four, you can play this. These are two protesters in Washington, D.C. And they were arrested for, I guess, marking the sidewalk with chalk. Chalk. What's the message? They're right out front of a Planned Parenthood building. And they say, pre-born Black Lives Matter. And there are the bystanders saying that they get out there and they do that every Saturday. But now they're arrested. Now they've got to be taken away. These are the evil right-wing chalkers. They're chalking up the sidewalk. And here, just weeks ago, we had people pouring paint out in front of Donald Trump's tower in New York City. Not equal justice for protesters, that's for sure. Only a certain type of protester is given free rein to burn Bibles, to trash federal government buildings, to chase down the police. This is from just another tragic story coming out of Chicago. PJ Media, it says, outside of cities in war zones like Baghdad and Mogadishu, I doubt whether any supposedly civilized city has ever experienced anything like this. It says 9-year-old Janari Ricks was heading to his friend's house to borrow a game controller. The straight-A student, an avid sports fan, was gunned down in a hail of bullets before he got there. Listen to this. Ricks became the 14th kid under the age of 18 murdered since June 20th. That since June 20 in Chicago. The body count is unbelievable. For the year, 212 kids have been shot, 36 fatally. Children in Chicago, 36 fatally shot just this year. And here you have entire sports teams taking a knee to support Black Lives Matter, to support what Antifa's doing in the streets. And all of these kids are being gunned down. And you have a Chicago mayor that just doesn't want help from the feds because, well, it's headed up by Donald Trump. And you can't take help from him. He's the crazy one. So just refuse it. Turn it away. And look at what's happening to children in Chicago. Here's a straight-A student. You would think that that would be headline news. But no, you have to go over to PJ Media. CNN's not going to cover it. MSNBC doesn't care. The New York Times won't write about it. Neither will the Washington Post. Or if they do, it's just a reference in passing. A 14-year-old, sorry, a 9-year-old, that was the 14th kid under 18 just this year. Just since June 20th, I mean. Can't even keep all these facts straight. 9-year-old boy, straight-A student. He loves sports. He was going to a friend's house to borrow a video game controller. And he gets gunned down. Is the one who shot this little boy? Where is he? What's his name? Is there justice for Janari Ricks? What about justice for Janari? Will that trigger a movement? Will that start a movement? PJ Media says the city has seen a 150% increase in shootings compared to last July. So far this year, murders are up 51%. Murders up 51%. 150% increase in shootings. Just since last year, is this a year like we've never seen before? Look at all of these crazy, crazy events. And there's no sign of it coming to an end. When you look at the violence, when you look at the COVID-19 hysteria, this was a PBS commentator on MSNBC over the weekend talking about the coronavirus epidemic and who's to blame. Clip 16.
If we had an actual attorney general in this country, he would be or she would be investigating and prosecuting the malfeasance, the negligence, the homicide, the mass murder. And it's gotten to a point with over 150,000 American souls gone that it's not just inexcusable, it's genocidal.
So, of course, the president's guilty of genocide. At one moment, he's the dumbest person in the world, and then the next moment, he's orchestrating this mass murder of fellow Americans. That's the way it works. He's the cause of every problem. He's the reason that people are dying. This was, speaking of COVID-19, Richard noticed this over the weekend. It was right at the end of a Telegraph article, and it said, you might have heard how that they reimposed some of those strict measures, those lockdown measures. I don't think quite as strict as back in April. But they're worried, like you've read or heard in the United States, they're worried about more infections. They're worried about a second wave. And this was at the Telegraph. It says, however, the ONS data has been jumping around wildly since surveillance testing began, ironically, because cases in the community are so low. Listen to this. It says the new calculation, this is in the UK here, the new calculation is based on just 59 people testing positive. I forget what region this comes from, but I guess it's from one testing center. 59 people testing positive out of 116,000 swab tests or 0.05%. It says the previous week, just 45 people tested positive out of 114,000. That's 0.39%. It means the tipping point for a northern lockdown may have rested on just 14 extra positive tests. So what they're basically saying is that you're having these wild swings percentage-wise, but there's just a handful of cases that they're basing this on. Any and every way that they can, extend the lockdown or the hysteria or the scaremongering. And then you have the experts in the United States, like Dr. Fauci, saying that when we need to wear goggles now, Dr. Birx over the weekend, she's the woman that was on the task force team. She came out and said that, we need to probably start wearing masks at home. It's not enough to wear them out at the shop or on the airplane. If you've got others in the house, particularly if they're older, you better strap on that mask. Fauci says put on the goggles. Fauci tells churches, you better cancel all the choir practices. And here again, it's in the middle of all these protests, and the protests get a pass. The protests are immune to, I guess, the sickness too, but they're certainly immune to the lockdown requirements. They don't have to abide by those. On Friday, Fauci gave testimony, by the way, in a Senate, or I guess it was a congressional hearing, and Jim Jordan spoke up and questioned him about this double standard. Here's clip five.
Dr. Fauci, do protests increase the spread of the virus?
Do protests increase the spread of the virus? I think I can make a general statement.
Well, 500,000 protesters on June 6th alone. Yeah. I'm just asking, that number of people, does it increase the spread of the virus?
Crowding together, particularly when you're not wearing a mask, contributes to the spread of the virus.
Should we limit the protesting?
I'm not sure what you mean. How do we say limit the protesting?
Should government limit the protesting?
I don't think that's relevant to...
Well, you just said if it increases the spread of the virus, I'm just asking, should we limit it?
Well, I'm not in a position to determine what the government can do in a forceful way.
And so there he is, and they go back and forth, cat and mouse, for the next 4 minutes over the difference, I guess, between a protest and a crowd gathering. He's very careful not to say, that they shouldn't be protesting. Now, crowds, you've got to be careful. We can't have rallies. We can't have church. We can't have choir practice. That's his expert opinion. You notice he said there right at the end, I'm not in a position to determine what the government can do in a forceful way. I'm just an expert giving an opinion here. Don't ask me about protests. I'm not here to say what the government can do in a forceful way. And yet, listen to what he said just a month earlier, clip six.
I can say as a public health official that I would urge the leaders, the local political and other leaders in states and cities and towns to be as forceful as possible in getting your citizenry to wear masks.
There he is giving his expert opinion a month earlier, saying to city officials, saying to government officials, saying to law enforcement, you be as forceful as possible to make sure everyone is wearing the mask. And of course, that statement, the one from a month ago, that came just, 3 months after he said this about masks, clip 15.
Right now, people should not be walking. There's no reason to be walking around with a mask. When you're in the middle of an outbreak, wearing a mask might make people feel a little bit better, and it might even block a droplet, but it's not providing the perfect protection that people think that it is.
And now it's just mandatory in his mind. You have to wear it, and city officials should be forceful in imposing this upon communities. Now, he's asked about protesting on Friday, and he says, look, I'm not here. I'm not in a position to determine what the government can do in a forceful way. And as I say, he went back and forth with Mr. Jordan in this line of questioning. Here's clip seven.
Well, I'm not in a position to determine what the government can do in a forceful way.
Well, you make all kinds of recommendations. You make comments on dating, on baseball, on everything you can imagine. I'm just asking you, you just said that protests increase the spread. I'm just asking you, should we try to limit the protests?
No, I think I would leave that to people who have more of a position to do that. I can tell you.
Government stopping people from going to church, Dr. Fauci?
Yeah. Government's stopping people from going to church. And he's had some strong opinions on that. But listen to him back away from the protests. He is not about to criticize that because he favors it. He supports it. He comes from the deep state. He comes from the far left. And he's very careful in his public statements, I know, about carefully walking that fine line. He's been in government for decades. He's worked in government, in the federal government, for decades. And yet you can read between the lines and know where he stands politically. Here's another clip from the hearing on Friday, clip 8.
That I'm not going to opine on limiting anything. I'm just going to tell you.
You've opined on a lot of things, Dr. Fauci.
Yeah, but I've never
said this is something that directly impacts the spread of the virus, and I'm asking your position on the protest.
Yeah, I'm not going to opine on limiting anything.
He's not going to give an opinion on limiting anything. So let those protesters go. Just let them ruin cities. Let them come out to get. Let them stand within 18 inches of each other, like the protest in London yesterday. Just shoulder to shoulder, marching, chanting, strapping on the black riot gear, marching through the cities of London. Here again, one more clip from Friday, clip 9.
I know it's difficult, but we're having a lot of suffering, a lot of death. This is inconvenient from an economic and a personal standpoint, but we just have to do it.
Well, that was obviously from earlier on in this crisis. That's his position on the lockdown. We have to do it. He said it was inconvenient. He knew it was inconvenient for people to shut down their businesses, to, in some cases, ruin their livelihoods. But we have to do it. Well, what about the protesting? Do we have to do that? Well, I'm not going to give an opinion on that. I mean, I'm just an expert. I'm just giving a medical expert opinion here. But I'll let the government officials decide what they need to do there. So many of the... Mr. Armstrong in that healing booklet, I read this several times earlier in the summer, late spring. He said, what then is the medical profession? Remember, it is only one of several... of the so-called healing arts developed by man. But the medical fraternity is by far the largest in number. They have allotted a very huge sum of money to operate a lobby in Washington, D.C. to influence government legislation. Now, this goes back to, I think Mr. Armstrong wrote this back in the 1960s and 70s. And here again, he's just spot on. This medical lobby. That's what Dr. Fauci's a part of. Probably the most powerful medical expert in American history. When you look back at what's happened over the last several months, look at what his influence, look at what his expert opinion has caused. And now he wants to back away. Now he wants to say, well, look, I don't really have any say in anything. I'm not going to say one thing or another about protests. What justifies us even paying attention to individuals like this? I mean, you've heard the clips. He's just back and forth. One day it's masks, and the next day, no. Now it's mandatory. Travel bans don't work. Now the travel bans save lives. This takes us back to Friday. Here's part of the questioning. Jim Jordan here is saying, do you understand the inconsistency where, you know, individuals that are running a gymnasium, they get arrested, but the protesters are just allowed to come and show up at Portland every single night. Clip 10.
Do you see the inconsistency, though, Dr. Fauci?
There's no inconsistency, Congressman.
So you're allowed to protest millions of people on one day in crowds yelling, screaming, but you try to run your business, you get arrested? And if you stood right outside of that same business and protested, you wouldn't get arrested? Okay. You don't see an inconsistency there?
I don't understand what you're asking me as a public health official to opine on who should get arrested or not.
He's just a public health official, he says. So he's not going to opine on the protests. Listen to this last clip where he draws a distinction, as I said a moment ago, between crowds and protests. Clip 11.
And we know the protests actually increased the spread of the virus. You've said that.
I said crowds. I didn't say specifically. I didn't say protests do anything.
So the protests don't increase the spread of the virus?
I didn't say that. You're putting words in my mouth.
No, I just want an answer to the question. Do the protests increase the spread of the virus?
I don't have any scientific evidence that anything.
So back and forth they go. The reason, again, the reason he makes this distinction between crowds and protests is because he, in the case of BLM and those movements, he approves of them. He supports them, even in the midst of a pandemic. But for everyone else, strict measures must be imposed upon the populace. This article that I went through just a bit of last week, from the American Mind, the COVID coup. It says here, in short, COVID-19 is not America's plague. It did not shake America. The ruling class shook it. They have not done it ignorantly or by mistake. They've done it to extort the general public's compliance with their agendas. Their claim to speak on behalf of science is an attempt to avoid being held accountable for the enormous harm they are doing. They are causing enormous harm to our nations. And you heard the way he backs away as soon as he's pressed about inconsistencies. As soon as he's pressed a little bit, he backs away and says, well, I'm here to tell you the science. This article says they continue doing it because they want to hang on to the power the panic has brought them. And so the panic continues. Crunched a few numbers just this morning, looking at population numbers and the percentage of mortality rates from back. I forget which one was the Hong Kong flu. I think that was 1967. But there was another flu epidemic. We know all about the Spanish flu. Just devastating. That was in 1918. I think that carried into 1919 as well. 675,000 Americans died in the Spanish flu from just a little over 100 years ago. And at the time, the population in the U.S. was 104 million people. It was a third of what it is today. And 675,000 Americans died. Mr. Armstrong wrote in his autobiography that people were dying all over the country, all over the place. If you consider the population back then, that's a death rate of 0.0065. So if you times that by the population today, you're looking at 1.125 million deaths, over 2.1 million deaths today. If you look at if you consider the population today and say, okay, it's the same population in 1918, how many would have died at that percentage? 2.1 million. Now, what's amazing is if you look at the flu epidemics from 1957 and 1967, there were 178 million Americans in 1957. And what were the numbers that died in that one? 1957, I think it was 116,000 Americans died. 116,000. So if you expand that on out, that would have been something like 100 and I think over 200,000. And the point I'm making is that the COVID deaths, if they've been counted accurately, it's at what, 158,000 right now? It doesn't even yet rise to the level of 1957. It's getting close to a rising to the level of 1967, the Hong Kong flu. But over the last 102, 103 years, Just by those three examples, COVID-19 is in fourth place. Soon it'll be in third place. Will it pass the 1957 flu? We'll see. I don't think it'll get anywhere near the Spanish flu. But in fourth place. And yet look, like that American Mind article brings out, look at how the ruling class, not the disease, the ruling class has shaken the foundation of our nations. The United States, Great Britain, you've seen the most extreme reactions in our two nations, Ephraim and Manasseh. If you just step back and look at the bigger picture, which no one will do in news media, they're just there to hype the story. They're just there to say people are dying all over the place. They're just there to say you stay inside unless you're destroying cities. We've never seen a year quite like 2020. When we come back, we'll continue with our study of Theodore Roosevelt, the one we started at the end of the program on Friday. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send feedback to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I don't think I held up this latest issue of Watch Jerusalem. You can see the cover there. What happened to King David's throne? Some of you don't get the actual hard copy of the magazine, but a little plug there for the watchjerusalem.org website where you can get to these articles and more. Well, over the past couple of weeks, we've talked about the cancel culture and all of the history, the wonderful history that's being deleted and erased. So sad to see what's happening to our universities, to see what's happening to our high schools and elementary schools, to see the history that's being left out, to see the history that's not being covered, and then to consider what it's being replaced with. We talked about Theodore Roosevelt, the American president there in the early 1900s. And at the end of the segment on Friday, we concluded, or near the end, we played this clip from Mayor de Blasio, the New York City mayor. The New York City Council decided that they wanted to remove this classic statue, this iconic statue out in front of the Natural History Museum in New York. And Mayor de Blasio came out and said he fully supported their decision. Here's what the mayor had to say, clip 12.
And I think Roosevelt himself is another one of these complex figures in American history. He did some extraordinarily progressive things that we feel to this day. And he did some things that I think are deeply troubling.
He said or did some things that were deeply troubling. So says this mayor who's ruining his city today, defunding the police, defunding the sanitation department. His city is falling into ruin. But there he is on his perch, his self-righteous perch. He's the judge and jury about Theodore Roosevelt. We talked on Friday about Roosevelt's education, just how ambitious he was, how much he was a man of action, a man of courage. And we'll just conclude today's program with a few points that we can pull away from Theodore Roosevelt's life. One being that he was a doer. He was a doer. He didn't know God's truth, obviously, but like the Bible says in James 1, we're to be doers of God's word. If we don't do, if we just speak or say it and we don't do it, we're deceiving ourselves. Theodore Roosevelt said, in any moment of decision, the best thing you can do is the right thing. The next best thing is the wrong thing. And the worst thing you can do is nothing. The worst thing you can do, he said, it's worse than even the wrong decision or the wrong thing. The worst thing you can do is nothing. Inaction. Thomas Jefferson, I've given you this quote before as well. He said, it's wonderful how much may be done if we're always doing. It's wonderful how much we can accomplish if we're just doers. If we're just doers of God's word. This is from Deuteronomy 1, verse 37. It says, also the Lord was angry with me for your sake, saying, you also shall not go in there, but Joshua, the son of Nun, which stands before you, he shall go in there. Speaking of the promised land, obviously, Moses had to stop just short. But it says here, Moses did, encourage him, Joshua, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. Joshua, as I've pointed out on a segment before, he was the cause because he was a man of action. Now, it's interesting. Moses said, now you encourage him because he's probably going to catch a lot of flack. He's probably going to be criticized. But he led the Israelites into the promised land. He took action. He was a cause of a lot of positive things. And so was Theodore Roosevelt from the beginning. He had a lot of disadvantages, even physically. He wasn't the healthiest boy. But his father really challenged him. This is from Edmund Morris's book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt. This is an exchange between the father and the son. It says, Theodore, the big man said, eschewing boyish nicknames, you have the mind, but you have not the body. And without the help of the body, the mind cannot go as far as it should. You must make your body. You must make your body. It is hard drudgery to make one's body, but I know you will do it. Morris writes, jerking his head back, he replied through clenched teeth, I'll make my body. The promise once made was adhered to with bulldog tenacity. He told his dad, I will make my body. I will do it. And he did do it. Further on in that same biography, Morris writes about how that Roosevelt was in the fellowship of doers. He was a doer. He had a setback during, I think it was a PE class or something, where he didn't, I think he had an asthma attack. And so he came away from that conversation with his father and then the setback later on in his youth. And he doubled down. He worked, as Morris said, he worked twice as hard. When he was a young man, because of his asthma and some other health problems, a doctor warned him to live quietly and choose a sedentary occupation. Otherwise, you're not going to live long. This was a case of a doctor trying to scare him to death. Does that sound familiar? He was trying to scare young Theodore. Now, you live quietly. Don't be active. Don't get outside very much. You could die. You could die. You know how TR responded to that? He said, "Doctor, I'm going to do all the things you tell me not to do. If I've got to live the sort of life you have described, I don't care how short it is." So he was going to live his life, even if it was cut short from too much activity. Well, it wasn't cut short, at least not that short. He, as I said, Friday, I think he died at 61 or 62. So he didn't live into his hundreds, but what a life. How do you suppose Theodore Roosevelt would respond to Dr. Fauci's advice to wear goggles and masks, maybe even masks in the house if you listen to Dr. Birx? No crowds, no choir practice, no church. Well, you know how he'd respond to that. He'd respond the same way most Americans would have responded before the year 2020. If you think about some of the things that we're doing individually, collectively, as nations, think of how preposterous it would have seemed just a year ago, this year. We went through crime statistics in the first segment. What was happening in Chicago back in July of last year? Well, if in July of last year, someone came up to you and said, "Yeah, actually, you're gonna have to quit your job. In fact, the government's gonna force you to do it for months on end." Quit my job? Well, what would I do? Doesn't matter. You're just gonna have to lock everything down. Stay inside. Well, what if I need to get outside? Well, if you have to, only if it's an absolute must. You can, burn down some stores, smash in some windows. Or if you travel, the thought of putting on a face mask and then a big windshield over that? Who would have thought of that? Even a year ago, even 7-8 months ago. Travel bans, government handouts. Richard Palmer's talked about this month here in the UK with the government paying half your meal cost out at the pubs. I'm sure, from what I understand, the restaurants, they're pretty full up as everyone's taking advantage of half-price meals on the government dime. I suppose I'll take advantage of it too. I haven't yet, but I will. But what is this doing to the government? And the debt levels that the government is carrying, and how much longer can this go on? Is it sustainable? Doctor, I'm going to do all the things you tell me not to do. I'm going to live my life. And he did. Theodore Roosevelt did live his life in the land of freedom, the land of liberty, the land of opportunity. And that's the way a lot of Americans used to think. He was a man of action. He was a real workhorse. Nations had talked for centuries about carving a canal through Panama. And Theodore Roosevelt comes along and he actually did it. He did it. He said, "Let's build it. Let's carve a ditch. Let's carve a canal." And there was sickness. People died on that project. I forget how many. I think it got into the thousands, if I'm not mistaken. Certainly hundreds. Malaria, other accidents, whatever. But he carved away. And there were critics. This is what he had to say about the critics. "From time to time, little men will come along to find fault with what you have done. They will go down the stream like bubbles. They will vanish. But the work you have done will remain for the ages." You see, little men criticize. Big men take action, decisive action, maybe sometimes wrong action. But in TR's view, the wrong thing, the wrong act is better than no action, is better than passively sitting back and doing nothing. The Panama Canal, in case you didn't notice, it's still around, isn't it? And those critics did go down the stream like bubbles, never to be heard from again. Now, the sad truth of this history is the United States, 20-some years ago, just gave it up. This valuable Seagate just handed it back over. James 1, I mentioned the verses. That's where it talks about being a doer of God's word and not a hearer only. Don't deceive yourself by hearing and even talking. You know, big talkers, there's plenty of them in the world. Don't deceive yourself by hearing and not doing. Be a doer. Join the fellowship of doers, as Theodore Roosevelt said. Now, he was also a doer, not just in the physical activity. He was a doer at the study desk as well. This is a man who wrote 38 books. He wrote his first book, The Naval War of 1812. He wrote that between the ages of 21 and 23. You compare that with what most 20-year-olds are doing today. I think the average age of the protesters in Portland is 28. So these are a bunch of 20-somethings out there pulling down statues, burning Bibles, burning the U.S. flag, destroying as best they can, destroying this government building, tearing down fences, screaming at police officers. All of these profanities right in the face of these police officers that, in my mind, they have a lot of self-restraint. But you listen to CNN, and what are they telling you? That the police are out there provoking this sort of riotous behavior. They're lying. They're lying about that. Theodore Roosevelt said, a thorough knowledge of the Bible is better than a college education. Isn't that the truth? While we're in the business of locking things down, let's just lock down the universities permanently and give everyone a thorough knowledge of the Bible. What if every university student today, instead of going to the university classroom, started studying the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence course? What an education! Where are their leaders today telling us that a thorough knowledge of the Bible is better than a college education? Theodore Roosevelt said that. So, well, what do? Pull his statue down, of course. Destroy the statue. Get rid of his history. Erase it. This was a man who was driven. This was a man of accomplishment. This was a man who accomplished much more in his life than Bill de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo and all of them others put together will ever accomplish. Matthew 22 in verse 36. Well, I can just paraphrase it, because another takeaway from his life is that this was a really amazingly social being, Theodore Roosevelt. He had a positive and profound impact on so many people that he came into contact with. And of course, again, when you look at it spiritually, Jesus said that the law can be summed up in two great commands: loving God with your whole heart, all your soul, all of your mind, and then to love your neighbor as yourself. To love your neighbor as yourself. Again, there's a spiritual dimension that was missing with Theodore Roosevelt, but still, there's some valuable lessons to take from this in the incredible human potential. Mr. Armstrong wrote, God's law, the basis of God's government, is the way of love, outgoing concern for the good and welfare of others, love toward God in obedience, humility, and worship, the way of giving, sharing, helping, and cooperating. This is what a young individual would learn if they were studying the Bible. A knowledge of the Bible is better than a college education. There's other examples that we can take from the Bible that demonstrate a tremendous love for other people. This is from Edmund Morris's book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt. It says here, such a combination of physical vitality and genuine love of humanity was rare indeed, and it's no wonder that his son, who was to inherit all of the former and rather less of the latter, called Theodore Sr. the best man I ever knew, adding significantly, but he was the only man of whom I was ever really afraid. So he feared his father's authority. He feared discipline coming from the father, but he acknowledged that he was the best man that he ever knew. What a relationship. How unusual. How traditional. Let's just delete that. Let's just take that away. Learn to love God and his family, learn to love fellow man the way that Jesus Christ did. That's a great takeaway from a study of this life. You look at the impact that the leadership of Teddy Roosevelt had on the Rough Riders. I got into that example last week. After they finished with that that task, and they got together for one final going away party, these were grown men, just overcome with emotion, heaving in tears because of this leadership, because of the power, the influence, and the love coming from their leader, Theodore Roosevelt. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit some feedback, I had some good feedback, but I didn't have time to get into it today. But you can email the program at td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you tomorrow.